4. Gravity. What makes something heavy? What makes something fall? William James, America's first experimental psychologist, speculated that infants perceive the world as one great blooming, buzzing confusion. But James was wrong. 4 decades of research using a preferential-looking paradigm, described in Chapter 2, have shown us that infants' perception of the world is much like our own. Infants perceive the objects in their environment as bounded, discrete entities that trace continuous paths through space and that move on contact with other objects. They perceive the people in their environment as agents of change, who act on objects to achieve specific goals and specific desires. And they perceive the environment itself as a 3-dimensional space characterized by depth, color, surfaces, and textures. There are, however, some marked differences between infants' perceptions of the world and our own. Consider the following situation. A table is placed on an empty stage, and a screen is placed in front of the table. A ball is held above the screen and then dropped so that it falls behind the screen in line with the table. The screen is then lowered, revealing one of 3 outcomes. The ball has come to rest on the table surface. The ball has come to rest on the ground beneath the table surface, seemingly passing through it. Or the ball has come to rest midway between the table and the release point, seemingly floating in the air. Adults would be surprised to witness either of the latter 2 outcomes, but 4-month-old infants are surprised only by the second. That is, they look longer when the ball appears to have passed through the table than when the ball has come to rest on top of the table, but they do not look longer when the ball appears to be suspended in midair. 4-month-olds thus seem to hold expectations about solidity, but no expectations about gravity. Indeed, their expectations about gravity, or more precisely, their expectations about support, develop gradually over the first few years of life. Adults expect an object to fall if it is not adequately supported below its center of mass. This expectation seems simple on its face, but is actually quite sophisticated. It entails a series of insights achieved in a regular developmental sequence, starting with the insight that objects fall if not in contact with other objects. Infants achieve this insight between 4 and 6 months of age, as shown by studies that measure infants' attentiveness to stationary objects that are either adequately supported or inadequately supported and should thus fall. In one study, infants were shown 2 boxes, one on top of the other. They watched a hand push the top box along the surface of the bottom box. The hand then stopped at 1 of 2 points, a point where the top box was still supported by the bottom box, or a point where the top box had been pushed off the bottom box, appearing to float in midair. 5-month-old infants stared longer at the floating box than at the fully supported box, indicating that they had developed the expectation that floating objects should fall. Nevertheless, infants of this age showed no surprise when they watched a hand push the top box to the very edge of the bottom box so that the 2 boxes made contact only at their corners. Thus, infants attend to whether or not an object is in contact with another object before they attend to the type of contact. It takes another month or two for infants to realize that the only type of contact that provides support is contact from below. Of course, contact from below is necessary but not sufficient for support. An object must be supported beneath its center of mass. For several months after they recognize the importance of support itself, infants do not attend to how much of an object is supported. 9-month-olds, for instance, are not surprised to witness a triangular block remain perched atop a rectangular support even after the bulk of its mass has been pushed over the edge of that support. In fact, expectations about how much of an object requires support continue to be fine-tuned throughout childhood. Young children, like older infants, recognize that the amount of contact between an object and its support is potentially important, but they do not heed the location of that contact. Children as old as 6 claim that an object will remain supported as long as half of its bottom surface is in contact with the support. They neglect to check whether at least half of its mass is located over the support. Young children are thus stumped by asymmetric objects, for these objects defy their amount of contact rule on two fronts. They can fall even if the majority of their bottom surface is supported, but the bulk of their mass is not, and they can remain aloft even if the majority of their bottom surface is not supported, but the bulk of their mass is. Children thus progress through a series of ever more refined expectations about support, moving from the expectation that objects without contact fall to the expectation that objects without contact from below fall to the expectation that objects without contact from below their center of mass fall. These expectations are evident not only from children's reactions to impossible configurations of objects, but also from their interactions with objects themselves. In one study, infants were shown 2 toy pigs, one that was adequately supported from below and one that was not, and they were encouraged to reach for whichever pig they wanted. Half of the infants were given a choice between a fully supported pig and a pig that appeared to float in midair. The other half were given a choice between a fully supported pig and a partly supported pig, that is, a pig whose center of mass hovered beyond the support and should have fallen. Which pig the infants reached for depended on how old they were. 5-month-old infants reached for the fully supported pig more than they did the floating pig, but they showed no preference for the fully supported pig over the partly supported pig. 7-month-old infants, on the other hand, reached more for the fully supported pig in both conditions. Infants' reaching preferences thus accord with their looking preferences. As noted before, 5-month-olds are surprised to witness an unsupported object remain aloft, but are not surprised to witness a partly supported object remain aloft, whereas 7-month-olds are surprised to witness both. Whatever the age, infants are wary of the configurations that defy their current expectations. Earlier, I noted that infants hold mature expectations about solidity long before they hold mature expectations about support. The same is true for expectations about continuity, that objects trace continuous paths as they move, and expectations about cohesion, that objects cohere as they move. Both expectations are in place several years before mature expectations about support. Why is support an outlier? Perhaps the concept of support is more easily learned from experience than the other 3 concepts. Organisms born with innate knowledge of support may have fared no better in the long run than organisms left to acquire such knowledge on their own. Organisms born without knowledge of solidity, continuity, or cohesion, on the other hand, may not have fared as well. They would probably have encountered difficulties learning those principles from the blooming, buzzing confusion that results in their absence. Solidity, continuity, and cohesion define the very essence of what an object is. They allow us to parse an object from its background and track that object across changes in location and perspective. Preconditions for answering the less essential question of whether an object has support. This evolutionary speculation is consistent with what we know about non-human primates' conceptions of physical objects. Monkeys and apes, like human infants, hold strong expectations about solidity, continuity, and cohesion, but only weak expectations about support. Indeed, adult chimpanzees' expectations about support are similar to those of a 5-month-old human infant. Chimpanzees attend to whether an object is in contact with other objects, but they ignore whether that contact comes from below or from the side. They are surprised to see a banana floating in midair, for instance, but they are not surprised to see a banana floating next to a box, in contact with that box only at its edge. Evolution seems to have destined primates to learn about support from experience rather than instinct, but humans far outstrip other primates in what they end up learning. children develop a relatively mature understanding of support within their first few years of life, but understanding support is different from understanding gravity. The latter entails knowing not just when objects fall, but where they fall and why. When objects fall, they often fall straight down. A spoon that has gone missing from your table is likely to be found on the floor next to the table, and a pencil that has gone missing from your desk is likely to be found on the floor next to the desk. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule. Objects in motion will hit the ground farther from where they fell, and objects whose path to the ground is obstructed will not hit the ground at all. As it turns out, young children do not take either consideration into account. They fail to attend to whether a fallen object was moving as it fell, discussed in the next chapter, or whether the object's path was obstructed. They assume instead that the object can be found directly below where it was last seen. We know this from what psychologist Bruce Hood has dubbed the tubes task. Since Piaget, psychologists have been interested in when and how children track objects across invisible displacement, namely, when and how they track objects occluded from view, as discussed in Chapter 2. Hood developed an invisible displacement task in which the displaced object is a ball and the occluding surfaces are opaque tubes. The tubes are affixed to a vertically oriented rectangular frame so that the ball can be dropped through them. At least three tubes are affixed to the frame, with each tube connected to a chimney at the top of the frame and a bucket at the bottom. The chimney and buckets are aligned so that a ball dropped into a chimney at the top of the apparatus would fall into a bucket at the bottom if there were no tubes in the apparatus. The tubes, however, redirect the balls so that a ball dropped into the center chimney actually falls into the left bucket, a ball dropped into the left chimney actually falls into the right bucket, and a ball dropped into the right chimney actually falls into the center bucket. Retrieving balls from this apparatus is trivial for anyone over the age of 4. All you need to do is determine which bucket is connected to which chimney. Children younger than 4, on the other hand, find this task surprisingly difficult. They tend to ignore the tubes and search in the bucket directly below the chimney where the ball was last seen, the left bucket, for instance, if the ball was dropped into the left chimney. They make what Hood calls a gravity error. These errors are not random guesses. Toddlers rarely search in the third bucket, the bucket that is neither connected to the chimney, the correct location, nor directly below the chimney, the gravity location. Likewise, toddlers rarely search in the bucket directly below the chimney if that bucket is not connected to any tubes, as toddlers realize they would have seen the ball fall through the air into the bucket. Toddlers' performance on this task is not black or white. They do not make gravity errors 100% of the time or search in the correct location 100% of the time. Rather, they search in the correct location more and more and the gravity error location less and less as they get older. Gravity errors thus seem to be the product of two conflicting beliefs, the belief that objects fall straight down and the belief that one solid object, the ball, cannot pass through another, the tube. Older children privilege the latter belief, recognizing that solidity always trumps gravity in this situation, but younger children are torn. The apparatus activates both beliefs, and they don't know how to prioritize them. There are, of course, other explanations for why toddlers fail the tubes task. Perhaps toddlers are confused about the mechanics of opaque tubes, failing to realize that objects exit tubes only at their ends. Or perhaps they are making an adjacency error rather than a gravity error, searching for the ball in whatever bucket is closest to the chimney where they last saw it, regardless of their expectations about gravity. Hood considered both of these explanations and showed that neither is correct. By laying the apparatus on its side and shuttling the balls from left to right rather than top to bottom, he showed that toddlers are not confused about the mechanics of opaque tubes. Under these conditions, which still involved balls and tubes, toddlers passed with flying colors. And by videotaping the task and reversing its motion, Hood showed that toddlers are making gravity errors rather than adjacency errors. In this setup, toddlers now watch the balls disappear from the bottom of the apparatus and reappear at the top, as if sucked up the tubes by a vacuum. Under these conditions, toddlers paid attention to the tubes and ignored the vertically adjacent bucket. The vertically adjacent bucket was no longer a preferred search location because gravity no longer drew their attention to that location. The tubes task is not the only task where toddlers make gravity errors. Another task, the shelf task, pits solidity against gravity without the use of cumbersome tubes. Toddlers are shown a cabinet with two doors, one above the other. Behind each door is a shelf. The doors are opened, and toddlers are shown that the top shelf has no cover. It is open to the air. The doors are then closed, and the cabinet is hidden behind a screen. A ball is then dropped behind the screen, in line with the cabinet. The screen is removed, and toddlers are encouraged to retrieve the ball from within the cabinet. A solid plank of wood separates the top shelf from the bottom shelf, so the ball could only be on the top shelf. But most two-year-olds search for the ball on the bottom shelf instead. They ignore the solidity of the divider and focus their attention on the lowest point beneath where they last saw the ball. In a variant on this task, toddlers search for a ball rolled down a ramp behind a screen. The screen has four doors placed at varying heights along the ramp, and a solid barrier, a block of wood, is placed on the ramp just behind one of the doors. The barrier is designed to protrude above the screen, remaining in view at all times. If the barrier were placed behind the third door, the ball would roll past the first door and the second door and come to stop at the third, prevented from going any further by the barrier. It would not roll to the fourth door, but that is where toddlers look for it. They ignore the barrier and presume that gravity pulled the ball all the way down the ramp. Watching an object fall causes toddlers to neglect the solidity of several objects, tubes, shelves, and barriers. We know that toddlers understand that one solid object cannot pass through another, because even 4-month-old infants understand that principle. Infants look reliably longer at a ball that appears to have passed through a shelf than at a ball that has come to rest atop the shelf. The task described at the beginning of the chapter is essentially the shelf task for infants. Why does gravity trump solidity for the toddler, but solidity trump gravity for the infant? For infants, the shelf task is really only about solidity, as they have yet to acquire any knowledge of gravity in the form of support. For toddlers, on the other hand, the shelf task is about both solidity and gravity trumps solidity because the task primes a well-practiced procedure, retrieving fallen objects from the ground. Toddlers may know as much about solidity as infants, but that knowledge is overridden by a reflexive urge to search the ground. Indeed, if you track toddlers' gaze as they perform the tubes task, they follow the ball with their eyes, visually tracing its path through the tube into the correct bucket, but then they search in the vertically adjacent bucket. Their eyes reveal knowledge of solidity, but their hands reveal only knowledge of gravity, similar to how infants' eyes reveal knowledge of object permanence long before their hands do, as discussed in Chapter 2. Toddlers' performance in hidden displacement tasks, the tubes task, the shelf task, and the ramp task, is thus a battle between their knowledge of solidity and their knowledge of gravity. The likelihood that solidity will win the battle can be increased or decreased by changing the demands of the task. It can be increased by removing the chimneys from the apparatus and dropping balls directly into the tubes, thereby focusing toddlers' attention on the tubes themselves. And it can be decreased by asking toddlers to track two balls at once, thereby overloading their limited attention spans. The tubes task has not been used with adults but researchers could certainly create a version that adults would find challenging. All they would have to do is increase the number of tubes and increase the number of balls. With enough tubes and enough balls, adults might even make gravity errors. Our belief that solid objects cannot pass through one another may be incredibly strong, but that belief is only as valuable as our ability to deploy it in real time. Human toddlers are not the only creatures that fail the tubes task. Dogs, monkeys, and apes fail as well. These other animals cannot be tested in the human version of the task, but they can be tested in altered versions. When dogs are tested, the balls are replaced with dog treats, and the buckets are replaced with boxes that the dogs can access with their snout. When monkeys or apes are tested, the balls are replaced with raisins or nuts, and the apparatus is shielded by a plexiglass screen to prevent them from tearing it apart. Despite these changes, the results are the same. Non-human animals make gravity errors on their first attempts to retrieve fallen objects. They also make gravity errors on the shelf task and the ramp task. The errors made by non-human animals are remarkably similar to those made by human toddlers. In one ambitious study, researchers at the Wolfgang Kohler Primate Research Center tested 4 species of apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans, on 2 versions of the shelf task, a vertical version and a horizontal version. In the vertical version, the apes were shown a table and 2 containers, one on top of the table and one below the table. The table was then covered by a screen, and the apes watched an experimenter drop a grape behind the screen, in line with the containers. The apes were then allowed to retrieve one and only one container from the display. Across several trials, they reached for the bottom container as often as they reached for the top container, even though it was physically impossible for the grape to have fallen into the bottom container. In the horizontal version of the task, the table was removed and the containers were tipped on their sides. They were aligned so that the right container blocked the opening of the left container. The containers were then covered by a screen, and a grape was rolled behind the screen from the right. Now the apes reached almost exclusively to the correct container, the one on the right, and ignored the container where the grape could not have physically gone, the one on the left. All 4 species of apes performed this way. They made correct, solidity-based responses in the horizontal version of the task, but vacillated between correct, solidity-based responses and incorrect, gravity-based responses in the vertical version. In follow-up studies, apes have also shown dissociations between where they look when tracking a fallen object and where they reach, similar to human toddlers. The apes' eyes reveal knowledge of solidity, but their hands reveal only knowledge of gravity. Searching for fallen objects is a task that any land-dwelling animal must perform, and humans are not the only animals that appear to have developed a simple heuristic for solving this task. Search straight down. Only humans can learn to overcome this heuristic, however. When non-human animals perform the tubes task for several trials, they perform better on later trials than on earlier trials, but their overall improvement is modest and slow. Gravity errors on early trials often give way to random responding on later trials, as the animals have realized that the vertically adjacent bucket is never the correct location, but have not realized that the tubes are the key to solving the problem. When non-human animals have practiced the task enough to solve it, they probably do so through pure association. They learn to associate each chimney at the top of the apparatus with a bucket at the bottom, paying no attention to the mechanism by which objects make their way from the chimneys to the buckets, the tubes. Human toddlers can learn to pass the task by association, but they can also learn to pass the task by other means. One way to help toddlers pass the task is to tell them where the fallen object has landed before they are allowed to search for it. This finding sounds trivial, but it's not. Other animals can watch each other solve problems and then mimic the solutions, but they cannot efficiently communicate those solutions, nor do they try. In the tubes task, human toddlers readily heed the testimony of an adult, passing over the vertically adjacent bucket in favor of whatever bucket the adult has specified as the correct location. Toddlers are not pushovers, though. They cannot be talked into making a gravity error if they saw where the ball fell with their own eyes. Nor can they be talked into making a gravity error if they actually know how to solve the task by paying attention to the tubes. Toddlers' use of testimony is thus nuanced and adaptive. Another way to help toddlers pass the task is to encourage them to use their imagination, that is, to encourage them to imagine the ball as it falls through the tube. When toddlers make a gravity error, it's because they allow a practiced response, retrieving objects from the ground below, to overshadow any other thoughts they might have about where the ball fell. Encouraging toddlers to use their imagination doubles their accuracy. They become twice as likely to search in the correct location and half as likely to search in the gravity location. We humans thus have two capacities, the capacity to use our imagination and the capacity to learn from others, that allow us to transcend a bias so deep that it plagues the search behavior of other primates for their entire lives. Do you believe that humans have walked on the moon? Around 7% of the American public does not. The U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, has broadcast video footage of several moon landings, beginning with the first moon landing in 1969, but conspiracy theorists claim that the footage was staged. These naysayers acknowledge that the astronauts on film move around slower than they would on Earth, but they deny that it's due to a reduction in gravity from 9.81 meters per second squared on the Earth to 1.62 meters per second squared on the Moon. Rather, they claim that NASA created the effect by filming astronauts on Earth in a sound studio or desert and then slowing the film to 40% of its original speed. But slowing the film would not alter how high or far the astronauts jumped, and they jump higher and farther than they ever could have done on Earth. Some conspiracy theorists have posited invisible wires and hidden harnesses as an explanation for the jumps. But wires and harnesses cannot explain why every object the astronauts threw, from bags to hammers to metal plates, traveled farther and higher than they would on Earth. Even the dust clouds kicked up by the astronauts' feet rose higher and farther than any dust cloud on Earth, and no one could possibly believe the dust was rigged with wires. Anyone who thinks that NASA's moon landing footage is fake has to overlook the effects of a low-gravity environment on every object in every frame of that footage. But those effects are surprisingly easy to overlook. The conspiracy theorists overlooked them, and many of the people who have responded to the conspiracy theorists have overlooked them as well. Why argue about the plausibility of invisible wires and hidden harnesses when the dust is a dead giveaway? Conspiracy theorist or not, we all find gravity's relation to mass difficult to understand. We learn when objects fall as infants and where they fall as children, but we do not learn why they fall until we are formally instructed on the topic, if then. We know that gravity is responsible for falling, but we don't really think about falling in terms of gravity. We think about falling in terms of weight. If your groceries fell through the bottom of your grocery bag, you wouldn't blame the Earth's gravity. You'd blame the weight of the groceries. Weight varies from object to object, but gravity is seemingly constant. So we ignore what's constant, gravity, and consider only what's not, weight. But this habit of divorcing weight from gravity has conceptual consequences. We end up thinking of weight as an intrinsic property of objects rather than as a relation between an object and a gravitational field, and we find ourselves unable to answer basic questions about either weight or gravity. Why do objects weigh different amounts on different planets? Why do objects in outer space weigh nothing at all? Why do moons orbit planets rather than be pulled into them? Why do falling objects accelerate at the same rate regardless of their mass? Why does free fall produce a sensation of weightlessness? And at the most basic level, why don't objects on the other side of the Earth fall off and float into space? Children are particularly perplexed by this last question. If objects require support from below, how could the underside of the Earth provide such support? Surely anyone who ventured to the underside of the Earth would fall off like a mouse who has crawled to the other underside of a large ball. Researchers interested in how children come to integrate their beliefs about gravity with their beliefs about the Earth have studied the process using thought experiments like these. Imagine that you have a new friend on the other side of the Earth. Your friend is playing ball. If your friend throws her ball up, where will it go? Imagine that your friend also has a bottle of juice. Imagine that your friend puts their bottle on the ground with the top off. Will the juice stay in your friend's bottle? Imagine there is a well hole in your garden that is very, very deep. So deep that it goes through the center of the Earth to the other side. Imagine that you dropped a stone into the well hole. What would happen to the stone? What are your thoughts? Presumably, you believe the ball in the first thought experiment will fall to the ground, and the juice in the second thought experiment will stay in its bottle. But what about the stone in the third thought experiment? People have actually contemplated this thought experiment since the Middle Ages. Scholars at that time were split between two views of what would happen. One, the stone would stop at the Earth's center, a view championed by the scholar Gautier de Metz, or, two, the stone would oscillate back and forth like a pendulum, a view championed by Albert of Saxony. Today, physicists endorse the latter view, with the caveat that air resistance would prevent the stone from oscillating indefinitely. Air resistance would slow the stone with each pass through the Earth's core so that it would eventually come to rest at the Earth's center, but it wouldn't come to rest at the Earth's center immediately. For adults, only the third thought experiment is truly hypothetical. The other two have known outcomes. For preschoolers, on the other hand, all three thought experiments are hypothetical. Preschoolers tend not to know or believe that people actually live on the other side of the Earth. Accordingly, they claim that the objects in all three thought experiments would leave the Earth and fly into space. Implicit in these responses is a straight-down conception of gravity, the same conception that biases toddlers' performance in the tubes task. Older children acknowledge that people do in fact live on the other side of the Earth and that their balls drop to the ground the same as our balls do. But the children are less certain about the fate of a stone dropped through a hole in the Earth. Most side with Gautier de Metz, reporting that the stone would stop at the Earth's center. This response signifies a new conception of gravity, a conception of gravity as inward pulling rather than downward pulling. The stone is thought to stop at the Earth's most inward point because gravity is thought to emanate from that point. It's not surprising that older children respond more accurately than younger children, but age is not the only predictor of how accurately children responded. Their knowledge of the Earth is a strong predictor as well. The more children know about the Earth's shape and its motion, the more sophisticated their responses to the thought experiments about gravity, regardless of their age. Apparently, conceiving of the Earth as a rotating sphere helps children conceive of gravity as an inward-pulling force. And conceiving of gravity as an inward-pulling force helps them conceive of the Earth as a rotating sphere. Gravity is not a concept that can be learned in isolation. It is inherently connected to several other concepts: support, free fall, weight, mass, acceleration, and planet. To develop a more sophisticated notion of gravity, children also have to develop more sophisticated notions of matter, motion, and cosmology. The inherent connections between these notions raise a paradox. How do we revise any one notion if doing so requires revising several others at the same time? The philosopher Otto Neurath once likened this problem to building a ship in the middle of the ocean. We cannot start from a tabula rasa. We have to make do with words and concepts that we find when our reflections begin. We are like sailors who on the open sea must reconstruct their ship, but are never able to start afresh from the bottom. Where a beam is taken away, a new one must at once be put there, and for this, the rest of the ship is used as support. In this way, by using old beams and driftwood, the ship can be shaped entirely anew, but only by gradual reconstruction. Neurath was a philosopher, not a psychologist, but his metaphor rings true with what we know about learning scientific concepts. The process is slow and hard-won because we have no existing templates for these concepts. We must repeatedly replace one approximation of reality, example, objects fall without contact from below, with another, example, objects fall without contact from below their center of mass. After many such revisions, our new theories look nothing like our old theories, but their lineage is unquestionable. Every astronomer starts out as a child who denies that people could live on the other side of the Earth, and every physicist starts out as a toddler unable to track a ball as it falls through a set of tubes. What a mighty ship we build from such a humble skiff!